Welcome to More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. Also, interviews with the most interesting people you've never heard of. Our guest today is Salona Bonvald. Salona, introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Salona Bonvald. I'm the founder of Leading Bit. I'm also the founder of a new nonprofit. We just sent off the 501c3 paperwork today, or a few days ago, for Fawcett, a Foundation for Open Source Ecosystem Technology. And I do a lot of work in data. I've been doing data since 89 with DBase 3+. I did my own graph theory database in the mid-90s and realized that computers weren't fast enough. And so I've been involved in data for a really long time, doing anything from like backend systems for massively multiplayer online game worlds to open data and government and things of that nature. And I've done a few AI projects, and now I'm involved in something also called citable AI, where you can actually, if you do the AI correctly, you could cite people with the results that you obtain.
Oh, so encouraging proper fair use.
Yeah, imagine that.
We don't want to steal from people like everyone thinks it's okay. Your comment about DBase 3+, I entered this world. You may or may not know, but I'm big into the Postgres world. And I founded United States Postgres. And I've also sat on the board of, Software in the Public Interest, if you've heard of them, for about 8 years. And I now sit on the board of another data-related nonprofit called PG Central. It's mostly around Postgres, but it's more ecosystem-driven. But awesome. Yeah, I started in this world on DBase 3+ and Clipper, remember those. Yep. All right, so let's talk about Leading Bit a little bit. You introduced yourself as having a lot of stuff going on. You know, evangelism for solar, fintech, digital rights. We're big into digital rights. We have EFF on often, multiple times a year. And in fact, it's not in our notes, but it might be interesting to have you on with EFF, as well as a few of our other colleagues. I just recently saw, and I forget what it's called, but it was a draft or a brief from our current administration, presidential, or, President Biden and so on and so forth, directing this idea to the FCC to give administrative control over the internet. Now, I have not read it entirety yet, so I don't want to say whether
I've seen that. I've got to go look it up.
If you feel free to like ping Lindsay and say, tell JD to send me that, because I can see the look on your face. I don't care who you vote for, but if you think you're going to give the government control over my internet, I'll stand up. And that's not a digital protest. That is all the Birkenstock wearing people in the world that understand what that really means. We are going to converge.
Are we China now? It's like, are we going to go create our own great firewall? Is that what we're going to do?
Well, I mean, that's the idea, right? The idea. And unfortunately, for all the good that the current administration has shown a willingness to do, it's also shown a willingness to violate the Constitution. And let's be fair, they all do it. But it's up to us, the citizens, to make sure they don't continue to do it.
Right.
So, back into what we were originally talking about. Talk to us a little about Leading Bit, because I looked at the site and I'm actually a little curious, and I mean no disrespect, but I'm actually a little curious if it's viable. Just based on my 30 plus years in the industry of open source. I think it's an interesting conversation to have.
Yeah, so what we're doing with Leading Bit is, and one of the reasons I actually created Fawcett, is we've been working on an open source platform of open source tools that we originally started on for IEEE SA Open, where we were doing like our, and a lot of this has to do with data autonomy, honestly, because of so many groups going through and taking your data and using it. And we're watching all these terms and conditions change now, where all these companies are like, oh yeah, I'm allowed to mine you for AI now, and I can do this now, and I can, and things of that nature. And so I kind of saw this coming. And the EU has been working on that too. And so since I started talking about this way back in 2004, the people from the EU remembered and like invited me back and said, okay, we're talking data sovereignty. What does that mean? And so, I brought in a bunch of those different things. And earlier you brought up EFF. And so I've been peripherally involved in EFF for a long time because I live in Austin, Texas, and I'm friends with Steve Jackson from Steve Jackson Games. And in fact, one of my friends at the time was working on Car Wars. So that's how I ended up meeting Barlow and John Gilmore and Mike Godwin and all of those people way back then. And then I ended up being on the board of EFF Austin for many years, for basically a lot of the early aughts. So helped them get all their nonprofit paperwork squared out because they hadn't been good about it for several years before I came in. And so a huge advocate about that. And so what I'm trying to do with it is I think there is a huge market. I'm just not exactly sure how I'm going to tap it because I keep having all of these problems with procurement and government because there's lots of money there. And I don't know if you've been watching, but like both France and Germany have banned Office 365 and Google Workspaces for government and schools because of the fact that they keep not being GDPR compliant. They want the data stored in country under their laws, not over here where we don't have any. You know, because we don't have any real privacy legislation in the United States. We're way behind in regards to that. And with our current status, I don't see when we're going to, you know, move forward, honestly, when we can't even do a budget. So, that's what we're trying to do. And so one of the ways that we're trying to foster that is by having a 501c3, not a C6, a C3, where we're bringing together all those different groups to tell us what they want and how they want to develop it. And so with this open source platform with productivity tools, we are adding in additional things to it. So first of all, we're open sourcing our infrastructure's code and all those different pieces. We're in the process of loading up a new instance of GitLab this week for that, actually. And then what we do is we want to add in enterprise search, which is something I did at PayPal. After PayPal decided to become InnerSource, which is like open source, but with 22,000 people worldwide, one of the first things they did is Denise Cooper got them to move over to GitHub. Enterprise. And then I came in and then we started doing this whole program for it. And one of the things that I found is that the biggest problem we had was silos and lock-in. Mm-hmm. And so I started doing enterprise search where we took GitHub Enterprise, 140,000 repos, Slack, 5,000 channels, Confluence, so big that it was taking 2 minutes to search it, Jira, Rally, and then 4 other proprietary tools and put them all together to do enterprise search. You could then search, you know, all 9 of them in 20 milliseconds and get high relevancy results. So that was really nice. And I'm going to add that into this productivity platform. So we're going to add enterprise search. But I ran into a problem at PayPal in that because of what I did, especially if you were a developer, I basically knew what you were doing every minute of the day, which is illegal in Germany. So I had to go and tie some things in, you know, in regards to what searches and the dashboard you're allowed to do and yada, 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 yada to like be safe in Germany. But, you know, it was like one of those things that I've been a huge advocate of privacy and identity for a very long time, for over 20 years. You know, I've been like, I'm Salona. Okay. I'm Salona.com. I was the only Salona on the internet in the 80s. All my Usenet stuff went to the web in the 90s. You know, it's just like, for a long time, it was mostly me. And so I realized that privacy through obscurity was gone. It was going to just get worse as things went through. And of course, that's where we're at now. And with the AI, it's even crazier in regards to that, right?
So let me interject here for a moment. I want to back up for our listeners who haven't heard of this, because you made reference to one of my favorite things to rant about, which was the EFF Steve Jackson Games, but you missed the part that's most important. And that is the EFF was created because of government abuse of power, specifically the FBI. And what happened was, is because our government is largely not full of the brightest when it comes to technology, they're more about policy and law. They heard of this game. Now, Steve Jackson Games is a game company that creates a system called GURPS and stands for Generic Universal Role-Playing System. And yes, when I was a younger man, I spent a good portion of 15 years playing either GURPS or D&D pretty much every other weekend, right? Well, what happened was is GURPS was developing a genre for their system called cyberpunk. And back then, this was back in the days when, as usual, companies didn't have the foresight to think about privacy, and you could hijack phone systems just by knowing the right tones of things.
Yep.
And so the government, without a warrant, without proper interjection, raided Steve Jackson Games, took everything they owned, and later found out, oops, we did something illegal, went to court, lost, and still have, to my knowledge, have never given back everything that they took. And at this point, it's kind of pointless. But, you know, as Salona and I were, you know, chatting just, you know, about EFF and stuff like that, this is why EFF is so important. FHIR is so important. GDPR, even though in my mind they did GDPR wrong because they still put the burden on the consumer. It's still better than what we have in the States, where law enforcement no longer needs a warrant. They just need a checkbook. Law enforcement now can just go to a company and say, hey, we think that there is a hive mind of criminal enterprise in the basement on 23rd in New York. Well, that's probably true. It's New York. But we don't want to get a warrant. So we, since you're collecting all this data from Facebook, Meta, Instagram, cell phone networks, pingables, all this type of thing, can we just buy it from you? And so every day, our government of freedom of by the people for the people is not. It's for let's see who we can trap. Anyway, that's my little rant. But let's talk a little bit. You said, you know, enterprise search, you talked about GDPR, you know, why Office 365, Google Worksuite. Talk to us what leading bit, what are you fixing with this?
I'm fixing a lot of things. So first of all, the reason I started doing the faucet thing is because I wanted a place to actually help open source go from project to ecosystem. You know, because right now the main place to do that is the Linux Foundation.
Sure.
And that's a 501c6. It's business. It's very corporate. You know, I don't know how many conversations I've had in the EU about the fact that they had like this weird construct in their mind about our nonprofit system. Because they were dealing with the Linux Foundation, they're like, "Oh, it's just a trade association." I'm like, "Well, a C6 is a trade association. A C3 is not. A C3 is highly regulated by the IRS and has all these other different rules." And they're like, "Oh, okay." I'm like, "It's like what you are used to as a nonprofit, while this is this other one." And I kind of feel like we've gone through like three stages of open source, where we had like first, you know, academia, and then we had corporate, and now we're starting to get into government. And if we don't get a lot of things set up correctly first, government's going to do the wrong thing, because we've been kind of bad about not creating standards and things of that nature. And so if you don't have standards in place, then you have these legislators who invent stuff, and they basically do it from talking to their buddies. Like, I don't know if you saw, there was an article, I think, was it in Wired or Forbes? I don't remember which, but it talks about this cabal of billionaires who basically infiltrated the White House to get them to do things a certain way that isn't the way that, you know, a lot of us who are talking about ethical AI want it to be done. And so, you know, doing a lot of that. So what we're trying to do on the whole, so doing the enterprise search, but then under that, we want to do individual search. And with that, I've worked with a lot of technologies. In fact, I did my own DLT in 2004, where I took Mercurial, which was, you know, versioning system back then, similar to Git, and Merkle trees, and did a distributed ledger of the federal budget, where I got the Cato Institute, Heritage Foundation, the Consumers Union, and the ACLU to all agree that they would host one of those copies of the ledger. But it ended up, the government ended up being my sticking point.
Yeah, they probably don't, you know, like people to know where the money is really going. Would be my guess.
No, totally. There's
a challenge here, though. I mean, I agree that, so I would argue that it, you know, free, just to be pedantic, free software was academia.
Yeah.
Open source is when you started to see your ecosystem being built. But now we're in phase three, because open open source, I mean, people, a lot of people don't understand, but this isn't a new thing. I mean, it was coined in, I believe, 99 by the Open Source Initiative with one of the founders of the Open Source Initiative. And, you know, its specific purpose was to bring about a more qualified term that people could understand specifically in business, whether it be small business, big business, whatever. Now, generally speaking, most of free software and open source do try to apply to IEEE, which you're fully vetted and aware of. But a lot of standards by IEEE aren't standards. They never reach that stage. And so we do end up in a situation where corporatism takes over, sometimes for the good and sometimes for the bad.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't hear about the good. But now we're, in my mind, we're in the third stage. And the third stage is where people like Microsoft are no longer saying, oh, this is our enemy. They're going to destroy us. We're a virus. They're saying, oh, look, these guys were onto something 30, 40 years ago. Now we're going to take it over. Right. And it doesn't mean that they're not good players. They do contribute to, say, Linux quite a bit. They do own, but not open source GitHub, for example. So there are, you know, good and bad. How are you going to overcome that? I mean, to me, first, let me say, I love the idea, but this is not something that SPI didn't try to do. It's not something that Conservancy didn't try to do. It's not something to some degree that EFF tried to do. There's any number of nonprofits out there, Apache Foundation. And the only one that's been largely successful, at least in North America, is the Linux Foundation, because they actually have people that understand business running the thing.
Right. So, you know, but at the same time, it does get perceived as corporatism in other areas of the world too. And so you have to like create a better balance. One thing that we were trying to do, and we tried to do this over at IEEE, but I don't think it stuck, where we tried to bring in more than just developers for doing that. And that's been my big argument for a while, is like, if you've noticed, when an open source project becomes an ecosystem, it's because of diversity. And it's because of the fact that you do get more users engaged, you do get designers engaged, you do get people who go around promoting you, you know, and evangelizing it and doing all those different things, where you like, you have to actually get all those things in place. And not only that, but you, I've seen it, like so many of the rules that I created at IEEE were because I had scars, you know, working in open source projects, where like, oh, we didn't grab the trademark, so some jerk did. Oh, someone purposely inserted some IP into it, which then like totally killed the open source project. You know, there's all those different kind of things that people need to take care of and do that I feel like we don't accurately represent to people coming into open source who are like, ooh, freedom, I can do this, I can do that, oh. And then they, you know, I mean, how much of GitHub is dead, or is abandonware? You know, the numbers I've seen of anywhere between 80 to 90%.
Well, there's a couple of things there. One, you touched on something, some of the rules that you brought into IEEE. Back in 08, I think it was, we ran a conference in the University of Maryland, Postgres Conference East, and I gave a general session where I was talking about the cowboy days, or the days of cowboy open source, are over. Now, this was 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And, of course, I'm in a room full of developers going, you don't know what you're talking about, man. Well, the reason Ubuntu is as popular as it is not because Debian is not as good or that it's better than Debian. It's because Ubuntu takes a people first approach, not a code first approach.
Right.
And if we ever want free software, open source, whatever, to be the predominant platform versus the platform that everybody just profits off of, you have to take that people first approach, because 99% of people do not think like a developer. 99% of people think, I don't give a shit how the code is written. I care that when I push the button J, a J shows up on the screen. Right? What?
Totally.
I think there's an ice cream truck in my parking lot.
there you go.
Yeah, so, you know, it's open source.
Well, that's one reason why we wanted to do this foundation, is I wanted to have a place where We could work with all these other open source projects, and we could go to try to chase some of this annoying funding. Because the problem is getting those government contracts, getting those grants, getting all that kind of stuff is so much gatekeeping. Oh my God, it's just a huge amount of gatekeeping. And that's why so many contracts go to the large consultancy firms, right? It's because they're like, oh, da, 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 da. And I'm just like, listen, if you want these to be done correctly and not accidentally kill open source by like giving huge contracts to somebody like Accenture that's going to go out there and not do open source best practices, okay? Let's be honest here. They're
terrible. Accenture's terrible.
Their whole profit-making thing is to throw more consultants in, right? And keep it growing and doing all those different things. And they'll purposely have people running five different versions of software so that they can have more consultancies rather than, you know, conglomerating them together correctly. So they do a lot of things that's kind of antithetical in their business practices to the collaboration that open source requires. And so that would be problematic. Mm-hmm. And so imagine if like all this money that's just been, you know, allocated through the executive order to doing these things gets grabbed up by those guys. Then it could
hurt open source too, because they know how to navigate the system. So my day job, command prompt, you know, we've been in business since 97, and we have two government clients, but they're only local government clients, right? They're county. And we've been approached to get in the GSA and all that. Frankly, it for us, it is, I can see where it's worth it if we had the runway, but we don't have the runway. We can't wait 6 months for the government to figure out how to cut a check, right?
Right, and that's definitely been the hardest part.
But Accenture, you know, I actually had a conversation with a potential partner. It didn't work out, but I had a conversation with a potential partner recently, and they wanted to use us for a very specific thing. And I'm not here to puff chest, but the very specific thing we are the best at, period, the end. Mm-hmm. It is what we do. We're very boutique. It is why people trust us. And we wanted to be their primary or their only distribution source for this very specific thing in North America for a period of time, right? Not forever, but 18 months, 2 years or whatever, to make it worth our time and worth theirs. And they weren't opposed to it, but they actually said, you know, we have a problem because what if Accenture approaches us? And our response was, well, guess what? They're going to screw it up and you're going to have to come to us anyway. And that's what a lot of people don't understand about these firms. And don't get me wrong, I think Accenture does have good intent. I don't think that they go into an opportunity and say, we're going to rip these people off. But I also think that they will hire anybody that's willing to be a slave for a period of time to achieve a result. And then when that period of time doesn't work out, they re-up the contract and say, we can fix it with this different person. Eventually, a lot of companies figure out either Accenture is the only one, or someone like Accenture is the only one that can help us because we need so many butts in the seat. Even though that is counterintuitive, counterproductive, and costs way more than it needs to. But it's what the management is being told by the supposed experts.
Slave.
Or they end up coming to us or someone like us who is a very boutique Amex Platinum kind of provider where we're not 150 people. We're 20 and we're solving a very specific problem. But yeah, I mean, with what you're saying, though, how do you adjust to the challenge? Open source folks, and we are of a certain maturity and wisdom, and we have dealt with these folks for more than 5 years, let's put it that way. And largely, a lot of these folks don't care, don't want. They're just like, give me my code. And no, you're wrong. We don't need X. And then what we end up with is a lot of situations today where I was just reading an article about Europe, and I don't remember who did it, but a bunch of agencies got together and said, we're trying to build out this standard platform for open source technologies. And then they said, now all you open source developers go develop it. And we're like, and the people were like, okay, where's our money? Where's our infrastructure? And like, no, these are our standards. You need to just go do it. How do we deal with that problem? There's a disconnect between reality on both sides.
Yeah, I saw that happen on a Gaia X post where they, and it was funny because like we started chatting about it on, you know, not a public mailing list. And there was a Gaia X person on there who's like, who did that? Oh my God, no. Don't say something like that. I was just like, yeah, no, there's no such thing as if you build it, they will come. Well, it's very rare. If you build it, they will come. And to be quite honest, you know, that's where open source has been successful, is when it's developer to developer, right? Where they can build it and they will come because, you know, it's Kubernetes or it's Linux or it's some underlying tech, you know, or like Apache, you know, this underlying technologies that developers have a serious need to collaborate on to get what they want and to get it done faster and better and things of that nature, you know. And so open source has been really successful on that. It hasn't been as successful on the user stuff, right? You know, I mean, LibreOffice has taken how long? And even then, you know, we still make jokes about it taking Microsoft Word and hitting it over the head and, you know, dragging off its design. But, you know.
Well, LibreOffice specifically, everybody's dropping it. I mean, and that is not to say I still use it often, but I use it for very one-off things like, well, and this is a Linux thing. I will do copy image from one app, but it doesn't go into the buffer correctly, so I can't drop it into GIMP. So I drop it into LibreOffice and then save it and then open it in GIMP, right? Weird oddities that you have to deal with, you know, just open source type usability. But, you know, a lot of distributions, because of its size, are dropping it. And there are, frankly, there are other open source opportunities out there that are slimmer, more featureful, faster, work with a modern UI. And then, frankly, Google Docs is good enough for 99% of people.
Yeah. I would challenge that 99% number.
Okay, 94%.
Because when I was at Hyperledger, one of the things that I did is I got everybody off of Google Docs and into Confluence. And one of the reasons I did that is because of, you know, we had a large percentage of our membership in APAC and in China. And they wanted to kill off these things that were happening in China. And I was like, don't you dare. And they're just like, oh, well, they're inactive. And I said, they're not inactive. I said, the problem is that you have meetings at 2 o'clock in the morning, their time, in English. And I'm like, and you expect everything to be documented in Google Docs. I said, that's not productive for them. And so as soon as I switched everything over to Confluence and had all the meeting notes and all the stuff happening there, they ripped through translating all of that documentation on a level I've never seen before. They even started like this whole ladder thing on WeChat where all 50 of them got in there and they're just like, well, I've done this many pages. Well, I've done that many pages. You know, they just like went gangbusters on it. You know, and it was just like, and I knew what was going on because I was on WeChat, you know, but the rest of the group wasn't on WeChat. So they thought, oh, nothing's happening. But there was a lot that was happening there that wasn't always visible because of the tools that we were using and how we were using them. And so they weren't as international as they need to be. And so I'm seeing that happen more and more with Google Docs. And also I had a bunch of other corporate people come to me and thank me for it, because they're like, yeah, I work at Oracle or IBM or somewhere, and they're like, and we're not allowed to, or military, and we're not allowed to use Google Docs. And so I was like, yeah. And I'm like, well, and the cool thing about it here too is it's much easier to, like, you know, yes, Confluence isn't as fancy with the layouts and blah blah blah, I'm like, but I can get it translated really easily. I can have all those different parts, they can stay in sync, there's all these tools for doing that. So, you know, it ended up being a really good call for us there.
Yeah, and I would concur. I was taking a distinctly North American view there. I hold a position for the Chinese PostScale Association. It's something like Director of International Collaboration or something like that. And before the pandemic, they were flying me once a year to Beijing to be a part of their conference. And that's something that I had to adjust to. Because suddenly, and it's almost Western versus Eastern, because if you think about it, you know, Western Europe, North America, and even to a certain degree, South America, Central South America, will all operate within a certain paradigm. But the APAC countries work in a very different paradigm, which is what you were just describing. And it's something we've run into in the PostgreSQL.org project. Was for a long time, because it's much better now, but for a long time, since it was so Western world directed. You know, the Japanese and the Chinese and the Singaporean, I don't even know how to say that one, Singaporeans, the Asians, essentially, they all created their own communities, vibrant, large communities that actually dwarf in a lot of ways the North American Western communities.
Yep.
But because of the disconnect with language and all that, they're like, you know, they do their thing, we'll download their code and we'll do our thing. So adjusting for that, I would agree with you on that level. If you're talking about a global influence, something like a Google Docs was, like you said, I mean, depending on the corporation you're in or even the region of the world you're in, you're not even allowed to use it or you won't use it. It's not going to solve that problem.
Yeah.
Now, when you say you go after government with LeadingBit, isn't that or with Fluent, isn't that a challenge? Because Europe works very differently than the United States. And not only that, with Europe, I mean, you could be dealing with France or the EU or Germany or Italy or all of them at once. And all the rules are a little different.
Yeah, no, they definitely have a lot of different rules. I'm kind of am cheating a little bit because my husband used to work at BAE Systems and did a lot of their cloud stuff. And so he was already used to dealing with a lot of the security stuff, a lot of the different auditing, a lot of the different compliance stuff. You know, I've done a fair amount of work now at this point in different standards. In fact, when I was at IEEE, I talked to 30 different standards bodies about the platform that we were creating. And in fact, NIN, DIN, and DNUM have done similar architectures already. And so they're kind of like, when I talked to them, I was like, well, I'm about to open source all the infrastructure as code stuff that we've been doing. And, oh, we figured out some ways to make this cheaper and make this fail safe better and all that kind of stuff. So they're really looking forward to us being able to start collaborating on that more. And so there's a lot of that that's going on. But with the different pieces, that's where I come into the part that might end up upsetting the most people is I'm a big believer in blockchain, but I'm a big believer, not as much in the crypto world, more in the distributed ledgers, using it for a bunch of different things. So one of the things I was wanting to do with the enterprise search is the individual search. And how the individual search would be done is it would be stored decentralized, and it would have, and the blockchain would be all about chain of custody and permissioning for that, so that you can actually, you know, lock your stuff up correctly. And then from that, we would determine what the rules are for if I create a marketplace, which is what we're planning on doing, of sharing the data to do the AI trainings. So then you would actually have these different pieces where I would do more the old school AI versus the new school AI, but use their weighting models and then be able to do some of that. So that's, I guess that's the special sauce that you were probably looking for LeadingBit, is the citable AI portion. So going in and adding these additional things to the open source because of the fact that it's open source and we can deploy it on all these different, you know, we can deploy it on the cloud and they can have it in country and they can do all those things. So they have their data autonomy, and then they can also get the other good features as well. So having both the privacy and the safety aspects on it together. I gave a talk to the UN General Assembly in the middle of COVID, where I basically promoted exactly this, where I was like, okay, location tracking is the most invasive information you can probably get on a person, other than like medical records. But of course, location tracking isn't protected in most countries. I'm like, but what you should do, I said, is you could do that where you have that data, you have the blockchain basically being a scientific double blind model. And then you could find out when people intersect and do the different things and do all the notifications without invading anyone's privacy.
So first, I would like to reframe your cheating comment. It is not cheating to efficiently use assets. And your husband is a knowledgeable asset that you are efficiently taking advantage of for the better of good. That's not cheating.
Totally.
Number two, let's explore that blockchain comment. You said you would upset a lot of people. Why do you think that upsets people?
Well, because all too often people look at blockchain as being crypto. And I have to keep explaining, no, the concepts for blockchain have been around since like 91.
Right.
Some of the tools for even doing that, like the DLT stuff, like Merkle trees, was from the 70s. And I just happen to be a bit of a nerd. So I'm like, oh, what's this? Oh, this would do exactly what I wanted to do over here, where people can't go and like change it behind my back. And, I want to, how do I get immutability? This is a good way of doing it. Doing hashes. All right, I'm going to go use that. And so I feel like a lot of times people don't understand that. You know, that was like a big part of what we were doing at Hyperledger, was trying to explain, no, we've got 15 different blockchains here who all do different things and all different flavors for all of these different reasons, because, it's about these certain characteristics. And it was, it was just like, but a lot of people automatically sit there and think that, I'm going the other direction. It was like, it's like the first time I heard about NFTs, I was like, awesome, this would be great for land deeds in Africa. And then it ends up being this other thing. And I was just like,
crazy ape thing.
I'm just like, okay, thanks, guys. Yeah, everybody made a lot of money. A lot of people know, the term. Unfortunately, they don't know the term in the same way that I do, which is basically, a public receipt with these validation methodologies on it. It's like, no, now it's this instead of these other things. And so that's why I get worried, is because I think, especially I do, I'm a pretty diehard volunteer for like the GBA, the Government Blockchain Association, and working on their standards stuff that they're doing. And then I'm also doing some stuff with the GBBC, which is the Global Business Blockchain Council. And they're also doing some standard stuff and things of that nature. And it feels like it's like a continuous conversation I have to explain that, no, I'm not talking Bitcoin, I'm talking, these sort of things. And so I have to constantly clarify that. And then I also have to constantly clarify how the technology works, and that it, and this is the technology that we need now. I do honestly believe that blockchain is the way that we're going to have to save the AI question, because we're not going to get accountability without that.
Yeah. I can't say I disagree with you. I mean, I've made money off of Bitcoin, just full transparency. I don't have any now, because anybody who is actually now, if you want to argue that the central bank system and all of that is a fraud, fine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I could actually, to a certain degree, agree with that.
Yeah.
But if you want to tell me that a bunch of cowboys who are largely crooks, who create technology to allow people to get rich quick, who get in first and then sell without accountability to anybody, is a better system, I have a third-rate libertarian party vote for you. And I say that as a registered libertarian. I do believe, I'm a big believer in individual liberty, but what a lot of people forget when they make these arguments is that individual liberty as a whole, freedom, requires responsibility and accountability. It's not about waving a flag and saying, don't tread on me. It's about having a more global understanding of responsibility and accountability to the greater good, which is what something a lot of parties or ideologies, let's put it that way, don't have. They have a singular view in how to be an authority. That's basically it. And it doesn't matter if it's the Green Party, the Republican, Democrat, whatever. It's a singular authoritarian view, which isn't accountable to the greater good.
Right.
So I don't want to get too geeky, especially considering who I am and who you are, because we do want to keep it a little bit approachable. approachable. I do have a lot of listeners that are like image engineers, high-end engineers that say AWS, and they love it when we geek out, especially when we get into policy-based stuff that's tied to technology. But we have a lot to talk about here. So let's talk about Chief for a moment, if that's okay.
Sure. So I joined it for a year, but then it's kind of expensive to stay in. And since I don't have the other money coming in, I kind of ended my subscription to it. But, it's one of those things that the reasons I joined it is because of how often, I'm the only woman in the room.
Sure.
Or how often I'm the only super technical woman in the room.
Sure.
Right. Which also changes certain things, like in the 90s when I was, in the gaming industry, and I was the person doing back end kind of stuff. And, it was kind of funny because sexism then was different than it is now, by the way. I got to be like a demigoddess back then because it's like everyone's like, oh, it's Salona. You don't want to mess with her because, you know, da da da. You know, and I'm not a hacker anymore, but, you know, I'm well past the statute of limitations on all that. But, you know, so I had that kind of standing. But then, like, when I went into open source in 2004, once again, 1.5%, you know, women. And so it was just like, oh, well, I really went to like find something where I can talk to women. And then the other problem that I started having is as I've gotten older, there's just not many of me, right? There's just right. Like you sit there and you see these job descriptions of we want so many years of experience in blah, blah, blah. Well, I'm typically one of the only women who has that. Mm-hmm. Because back then I was the only woman in the room. And guess what? I'm still the only woman in the room with that level of experience. You know, it's just, and so that's why I joined Chief is because I wanted to have some hard conversations with other high ranking women because too often, you know, while I love mentoring, don't get me wrong, I love mentoring. I felt that I needed some peer and peer to peer interactions. But it didn't actually work for me because I didn't meet a bunch of other technical. I only met like two other technical women. And so it's just kind of like, okay, you know, that's not exactly what I wanted. I actually wanted something where I could get more, you know, mind meldy. And I'm also, you know, like many highly technical people, I'm very on the spectrum. And so mm-hmm. sometimes I make mistakes that, and so that's another reason why I wanted to try to get into that is because I wanted to figure out how better to talk to other women who aren't nerds because I'm not good at it a lot of times. And so it's kind of like, how do I do that so that I don't accidentally overwhelm people with technical knowledge or seem unapproachable or, you know, all that kind of stuff that I normally accidentally do when I don't mean to. At PayPal, they did this executive training where they took a video of me. And evidently, I have resting skeptical face. And yeah, and it was funny because I had one of my employees in this training with me because I yanked her along and I said, you're coming with me because I wanted her to also move up the ranks. And I turned to her and I'm like, you know, Priya, do I? And she's like, yeah.
I have no comment.
And it was kind of funny because like then I ended up talking to my team about it, you know, and so I sat down like my four managers and some of the other devs and I was just like, by the way, and they're like, oh, no, we know, Salona, we know that just means you're listening intently to us, you know, and so, and not only that, but I was very good about giving them space to talk and all that, and so they were like, no, your resting skeptical face doesn't upset us at all, and then I realized also that I was probably the reason so many times at the end of the meetings, people would sit there and go, so, Salona, what do you think? And it would give me an opportunity to actually talk at a meeting. So, you know, that's often dominated by men where, you know, I talk for 5 minutes and I'm dominating the meeting. And so I decided that I wasn't going to get rid of my resting skeptical face because so, it meant that people would check in with me at the end of the meeting.
full disclosure on this. My long before this was the rallying call of the young, the first demonstrable moment in my life that my privilege was checked. Mm-hmm. I was working for a technical bookstore. This is actually, it's how I got into tech as I was working for a company called Pals Books, which mm-hmm. in Portland, they have the world's largest standing bookstore. Mm-hmm. But they had another store at the time because tech was special. And you know, this is when cell phones were the size of briefcases. Mm-hmm. And I had a lady, I was running the cashier and she came up and she handed me a book to buy. And this was like some master's or PhD level physics book. Mm-hmm. And this will make those who know me laugh. This was when I was even less, I don't want to say considerate, but let's call it aware of social mm-hmm. cues. And mm-hmm. social standings and the way you're supposed to ask questions. I would just like, right? I'm asking a question.
Yeah.
Some have suggested that perhaps I'm on the spectrum. And out of my mouth was not like in where I am today, I would be like, this is an interesting purchase. Can you, you know, how does this relate to you? And then that would allow the individual to say, oh, I'm this or that or this or that.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I said, do you actually understand what's in this book? And she looked at, she was so grace-filled. I remember this woman to this day, and this was over 30 years ago, right? And to mm-hmm. this day, I remember the look on her face, and she just got a little, like, the little smirk you get, and she said, I have a PhD in physics. And so I bowed to her, was like, okay. And I handed her a book and her receipt. And it wasn't that I didn't think, and I still don't. It's not that I didn't think that a woman could do it. That is not the case mm-hmm. at all. It's that I'd never run into a woman mm-hmm. who was doing it.
Right. Right.
And now in my life now, I still don't, although it's better, mm-hmm. I find that when I run into a group of women who are technical, mm-hmm. It's largely not in something that's comp sci. It's physics, it's medicine, mm-hmm. it's DEI research, it's cancer research. It's those other sciences that largely rely on the sciences that you and I are doing every day.
Right.
So I do find the whole conversation interesting about you, like you were the only woman in the room. And I don't foresee that, at least in my lifetime. And I'm hoping mm-hmm. I got another 50 years left. I don't see that predominantly changing, right? I don't mm-hmm. know that, and if I'm wrong, great, bring it on. I'm not suggesting one way or the other that it's right or wrong, just that I've met a lot of women in tech who don't like the stuff that you like. They end up finding a secondary path into tech, like breast cancer research or something mm-hmm. like that. And maybe I'm wrong, and like I said, bring them all on. I the more diverse avenue of thought we have, the better off we are, right? Mm-hmm. But that, anyway, that's just kind of where I was going with that, is I've seen that. But she, you know, Chief says, you know, what is this, you know, $7K a year. One, I'm not paying $7K a year for something unless I'm getting $70K a year back in value.
Right.
Right. Obviously that they were not giving you, or you were not able to accumulate that kind of return, whether it be monetary right. or time or whatever. But what is, you know, this idea of a personal board of advisors? I mean, isn't that just your group of your close group of friends? I mean, what is this idea here?
What they do there is it's kind of like it's a type of counseling where you get together with a group of women and you go through this entire process in regards to evaluating where you are and where you're going and, you know, your challenges and stuff. So it's kind of coaching. But you're coaching with a bunch of other women who are supposed to be all on the same level as you. And I think like the problem that I found with some of it is I liked them all and I liked the sessions, and the woman who was running it was good. But my challenges are just so different mm-hmm. from everyone else's that I felt like a lot of times people didn't understand the scope. But it was better than another one that I did that was a bunch of dude bros. Like, oh God, I had one and he was just like, you know, his main goal there was to be able to have better work-life balance so that, you know, he could babysit his kid. And I'm just like, just go fuck off. You know, anyone who talks about babysitting their own kid can just, you know, go take a very long walk off of a very short pier as far as I'm concerned. you know, it's like, seriously. But you know, and that was the kind of thing there is they're like, oh yeah, work-life balance and work-life balance meant that this them. And then of course they were also all very young. And so, and I'm sitting there and like, I'm sitting there going, well, I'm trying really hard to make a decision between this. And it was all very huge, very global impact programs. And I was like trying to figure out, you know, what I wanted to do in regards to that. And they're just like, oh, well, do you have a PM? And I'm like, yes. You know, I'm not, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, well, do you have project managers? It's just like, yeah. I said,
this stuff is above a project manager. This is,
I'm like, this is what C-levels do. C-levels sit there and go, in the world, where are the different things? Can we get these? Can we hit these verticals? Can we do this? Can we do that? You know, just like you were asking me earlier, they're like, ah, I'm not sure if that's going to be able to make money or not. And I'm like, ah, I'm doing these things to try to make sure that it does. You know, it might be a little bit complex, but you know, I think the drive to data autonomy is going to help me out for all of those different things. And I think AI is actually going to drive a lot of people to come to me to say, help me, please. So, you know, that's where I'm going. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of decisions I'm trying to make.
Sure.
Not, you know, do I have enough time in the day? It's like, no, where do I think I can find, what is it that Buckminster Fuller talks about, the little, damn it, now I'm forgetting the name of it, the little tab on the rudder.
Oh, right.
You know, it gives you the leverage. I'm like, I'm constantly trying to sit there and say, where's that little tab going to be so that I can get that to sit there and move these things in the directions that they should move in? You know, and that's why I started doing open government in 2004. I was a legislative late. I quit the gaming industry because I got mad because my game went from being something that was going to be cool and meaningful to another first person shooter. And I'm just like, I'm out. And I quit. And then I'm like, well, now what do I want to do with my life? I'm like, I'm tired of the gaming industry. I'm tired of the addiction filled stuff that they keep doing. I wanted to do something better and more meaningful and, you know, that sort of thing. And so then I was like, well, I went and like, because I was on the board for EFF, I was like, oh, EFF Austin. I'm like, oh, well, I'll go help out with the ACLU. And so I became their legislative liaison for technical issues for the Texas legislature. And I was a person who talked to Republicans. And I went on 9 out of my 10 issues. And in fact, it was to the point where everybody assumed I was a Republican. I'm like, no, not a Republican, not a very good Democrat all the time. I'm like, libertarian leanings, but okay. When it comes to technology, it's like, no, you know, this is what's good. This is what's not good. This is how it's going to work. This is what this is going to end up costing you. This is how this is going to happen, you know, da, da, da. And I was able to go and do that. So I went on 9 of my 10 issues. And the one that I lost on, I, to this day, think that money was under the table.
Well, that's politics, number one. Yeah. But I actually want to touch on 2 things. One, you said something which I thought was just classic. It's a new term that I am going to add to my vernacular, and I want to thank you. And that's dude bro. I've never heard dude bro. I've heard dude, and I've heard bro. I've never heard dude bro. Can you give me the 3 sentence of what is a dude bro?
Well, first of all, they use dude and bro too many times. So that would be one piece of it. Because there's dude and then there's bro. You know, that happens too much. Normally, I think of them as being younger, not so great with the gals. They think they are. They think they are, but a little bit too self-focused. I view them as being not the nerds. So, because one of the things that I found is that, you know, in tech these days, there seems to be like, and this is overgeneralizing, but, you know,
it's
hey,
okay.
We're here, so let's go for it.
Yeah.
You've got the nerds and you got the dude bros, right? And so you've got the nerds, which, so I'll push back on you here. So okay. The nerds who created Bitcoin had some really awesome stuff as to what they were doing and why they were doing it and how they were doing it. And they got really nerdy with it. And it was all about freedom and like all this other different stuff. And then you had the dude bros come in and commercialize the crap out of it and all this other crazy stuff happened. But the dude bros never, you know, they can talk tech like a parrot or like ChatGPT, but they don't actually like know the tech on the same way as the nerds do. Does that make sense?
It does. And to be fair, though, and I don't want to apply this to dude bros because the dude bros in my mind are the current dude bros are the AI. Everyone out there, AI bought this. AI,
they jumped from blockchain to AI now.
Yeah. This is the new thing I'm going to make my riches off of. And they're largely going to fail and they'll wait for the next marketing term.
I saw so many people come up as AI expert, to which I'm like, I know you people. And you have never worked on a single fucking AI project in your life. And yet now you're the AI expert.
The moment ChatGPT-3 came out and everybody's like, oh my God, all of a sudden you've got the entire marketing scheme of Apple, Microsoft, Google, always AI, 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 AI. And frankly, it's because of this. All 3 of those companies market to the stupid. It's not that's not for, let me say the either uneducated or the ignorant, because those people, they're not necessarily stupid. They actually may be brilliant in their particular field.
Right.
But they actually don't care about any of the other stuff as long as it makes their life easy. And go ahead.
Can we create another term for people? Because like, I hate ignorant and I don't like stupid, but I do feel like there is like this unawareness of the fact that, yes, you may be good at such and such, but you're not good at these other things. You haven't done them. You don't actually understand how a lot of this works, you know? So and that's like, and that's what I feel like happens with the AI is because I've been peripherally involved in several AI projects now. In fact, I was peripherally involved way back in the early 90s for the accidental invention of clean coal. You know, and so it's just like, it was actually a very early application of industrial IoT with machine learning. And so what happened is you have all the sensors all the way through and they kept overtraining and they kept doing a whole bunch of other different stuff. And I was like, listen, we know the end game for these sensors and it's chemistry. I'm like, why don't we go through and make sure that when we're tuning these models, we're going towards that. And that's how they went from 80 to 99.99%, you know, efficiency is by boom, doing that. And so, and then I worked with another group called iGorithm that was doing visual recognition. And the cool thing that this woman did is she actually had the computer be able to see the same optical illusions that we did. And then once that happened, it was able to do a lot of really interesting stuff in regards to picking out the subject, telling you what the subject is, all these different things. This is like 2011. And because of the way that she had done those training models, and I was like, because she knew a known good. And I'm like, and so one of the problems I see with these other models, and I predicted a lot of it. I sat there and I'm just like, oh, well, a bunch of these are going to, you know, crap out pretty soon when they start, you know, ingesting their own poop, basically. You know, that Shel Silverstein comic. Have you ever seen that one? I was like, yeah. I'm like, once that starts happening, those models are going to break. And people are like, what? And I'm like, well, you're going to have to figure out, you know, I said, but then they'll probably come up with something where they can maybe identify their stuff and then don't scrape it. You know, but then the funny thing that happened is the Internet Archive ended up getting crashed a bunch of times by effectively getting DDoSed by people trying to scrape it instead of the current internet because they wanted to make sure that there was no AI in there. You know, so well, that's what's going to happen, right? I mean, because like, I mean, Twitter for a little while became good again when the whole Ukraine thing happened because everybody shut down all the Russian stuff. And so all their bots stopped working. Mm-hmm. And Twitter for a little while was good again. Like it was like it was at the beginning.
Don't say great again. Good again.
It was good. It wasn't great. But actually it was better than it had been.
Well, so on your comment, you think we need to come up with a different word. I want to come back to one of your experiences that I had as well. I was, 2 years ago, I was invited to a peer group, similar to, you know, Chief, mm-hmm. where you get together with, but it wasn't gender specific. It was just, you know, C-level execs of, you know, right. of small to medium-sized businesses get together and explore issues. And one of the interesting things about this group is they actually interviewed people who were wanting to join. So what you do is you mm-hmm. would come to the group as a normal member for one mm-hmm. time. And then at the end, that group would vote on mm-hmm. whether or not they felt that you would fit in.
Right.
So I sat through this thing and I participated and so on and so forth. And at the end, I was not accepted. Mm-hmm. And what I found out was the reason I wasn't accepted is because we're successful. Everybody in the group, it wasn't that they didn't have success, but they were describing problems of a simple nature that it was themselves the reason they couldn't overcome them.
Right.
And these are problems that, from a command prompt perspective, mm-hmm. I learned years ago how to get out of my own way.
Right.
When I start beating against a wall, I either climb the wall or I hire someone who can climb it for me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's just mm-hmm. that simple, which is like yourself. I am long past due date. I no longer do engineering. I still do architecture, mm-hmm. but I don't do engineering. I'm just not mm-hmm. as good at it as I could be, or frankly, even should be, in order to make sure that the rest of my engineers are actually successful.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But what's that term going to be? Because ignorant is not a bad thing. Ignorant just means you don't know. Stupid is a bad thing.
Right. But the problem is people do view ignorant as a bad thing. But then the problem that I have is you know, more that like someone is good in this, but then they, you know, okay, I'm gonna be naughty.
Please do.
Salespeople so good at sales, but then they'll come in and I'll have so often where I'm gonna have to talk them down on the tech because they'll think that they know the tech and they'll have all this vocabulary, and this is like the quintessential dude bro. They'll have all this vocabulary and they'll think that they understand the tech because they've watched some YouTube videos, but it's like, dude, you do not know the tech. You know, and that's also part of the problem with ChatGPT, right? Is that all these people sit there and they go and they get in there and they do something. And it's like, well, that sounds reasonable. It's like, yeah, but it's wrong. You know, it's like there's several huge things that are wrong. But the problem is they don't know enough to know that they're wrong. And then they use it. And it's just like, oh, how are we going to do something with peer review? But anyhow, but that's the problem that I see on a lot of this stuff is people artificially think that they're good at things that they're not good at, because like ideas, you know, I don't know how many times people think that they've come up with something special and it's like, well, you haven't, you know, it's like, and if you wouldn't did, you know, some good research, you would find out that that isn't new. You know, those things have existed for a while. Go sit there and see what they did and then sit there and see if you can add something new to it. But, you know, cause I mean, and I went through that phase too. I mean, like when I was in sixth grade and found out about Thoreau, I was like, dude, this is the entire thing I've been thinking about this entire time. And this guy already did it.
Well, on that, it's funny you bring that up because years ago, I had a buddy that he's quite a bit younger than me, about 15 years younger than I am. And I kind of became his mentor and I was helping. He grew up homeschooled, which let me be very clear. A lot of, I would say most homeschoolers are exceptional. His homeschooling experience did not involve a lot of books, involved a lot of hands-on, which made him very good at things like contracting, building decks, that type of stuff. And so I started a contracting company with him to kind of like propel him forward in his life. And what, this was right when the stand-up desk craze came about. Even though it was stand-up desks aren't new, it's when everybody started talking about standing up desks, right? And we came up with this design and we called it the X desk. And he approached me one day so excited, just, I mean, like boyish excited, you know, just proved that, you know, jack-o'-lanterns can come alive at night, that kind of thing. And he said, can we patent this? And I smiled and I said, brother, I so appreciate your willingness to, you know, want to pursue protecting what we've created and things like that. But what you have to understand is all we did was create an ironing board with a bigger top. That's what it was. It was an X-Dex. It would go like this and then like this. And it was just, right? It wasn't new. There, it was just, we put a bigger top on it. Now, frankly, patent examiners aren't that bright. So maybe we could have gotten through.
You probably could have in my experience.
Yeah, but it wasn't the fair or right thing to do, right?
No, exactly.
So, okay. Let's talk about, you mentioned this in the very beginning, and there, we're getting a little low on time. So I want to make sure that we address two things real quick. First is citable, because this intrigues me, because I don't care to the general populace. You need to understand that what you're doing with AI right now is largely stealing.
Yeah.
Right. This is why a bunch of artists and musicians have started filing lawsuits. You know, you're not, this isn't fair use doctrine. This isn't educational or academic. You are a short path to theft. And theft is illegal for a reason. You do not get to scrape my thoughts, my writings, without citing them, because they are my thoughts and writings, not yours, and not fucking ChatGPT's. Pardon my French.
Right.
So let's talk about citable first. Please elaborate on that.
Totally. So I came up with the term citability in 2005, which wasn't a word yet, by the way, which is like a funny thing to like realize, but all that existed was the word citation. I went and looked in four different dictionaries, did all sorts of Google search, nothing. So I registered citability.com and .org and started talking about having all of the government documentation open and citable to a granular level. And so that was like part of the thing with the whole Mercurial and Merkle trees. So it could be like for the legislation, it would be archive.house.gov.session time date stamp slash title section subsection chapter subchapter paragraph clause. And so I was like, well, I want all of the data to be open and like that so that we can start citing it. And so we had a think tank where we talked about what is citability. Why did we develop citations the way that we did? Why did we do all these different things? We had it over at the LBJ school, and it was moderated by this fabulous woman named Betty Sue Flowers. And we had this whole thing about, no, this is what's going to happen, because previously everything that we did was dependent upon this, the publishing model.
Oh, publishing model.
Right? Okay. The book.
Yeah.
You know, it's all dependent upon that. And so we're going through the next Gutenberg phase, right?
Yeah.
And so since we're going through the next Gutenberg phase, we don't have the weird things that we were able to create because we were doing this, and there was like a gatekeeping method for it. So therefore, you know, it could be more real and things of that nature. And with the internet and with all that different stuff, we don't have that anymore. So now what do we do? You know, and that's one reason why we invented things like copyright, is for a lot of that to handle it. And so we do have to go back to something along those lines. So what I was doing with the citable AI is I was like, well, okay, AI, those training models are going to start having problems soon, because they just will, because anyone who's worked in AI will tell you at some point your models are going to go weird out on you, and you're going to have to go there and fix it. And you're going to have to try to figure out what way it's going to be for doing that. And it's like a constant battle, and people are going to start purposely poisoning the AIs and doing a whole bunch of other different things, which are already happening. And I'm like, so how do we do this safely? And also, how do we do this so I can take advantage of these things and not, you know, give everything away? And so I was like, well, you know, I can go take, you know, because I do actually know a few things about, you know, AI, and studied a bunch of this stuff way back when in the early 90s. I'm like, well, this is what we could start doing with it, is we could take these other somewhat chaotic things, add these other things into it, and then these other pieces will be better. And in fact, I think that like taking your own data and doing that, there's like five different things on Hugging Face at this point where you can go in there and do that. And I was like, well, that's good. I'm like, but I know that people still want to collaborate. And so I'm like, so what can we do to allow it so that we could collaborate and we could do it safely, where I don't have to worry about you stealing all my stuff? You know, and so that's where the citable AI came out of, where we could bring our data models in, do the different things, create the stuff. And then what happens is on the platform, you pay the copyright owners. So you're like, oh, you go in, you create this marketing plan, it comes back. It's like, oh, it's 50% Selena, 25% Raul, and 25% Beth. Oh, okay, great. Would you like to pay the owners? Yes. Now, what does that do? You're no longer in copyright law, are you? You're in ownership law.
Yep.
And that has value, that has a lot of court protections, that has a lot of those different things that a lot of international agreements, things of that nature will actually come into play. I am concerned about how this is all going to work, you know, internationally, because I know that certain countries are never going to play by those rules. It's kind of like not part of their culture, honestly, right, to play by some of those rules, because, you know, we're very individualistic and they're very communal. And so those end up being like, you know, and it's funny because if you have the conversations, like, they don't, you know, in an emotional way, they don't get it.
Right.
Just like in an emotional way, sometimes we don't get what they're doing either. And so to me, this is the only way that we can start to do that, because I'm worried about the megaliths right now, because like, if we don't allow any public stuff, then the only people that are going to have data sets that are going to be large enough is like Google and Facebook, mm-hmm, and Microsoft and da-da-da. And then they'll purposely drag you in with those terms and conditions, which is what they're doing now, right?
Right.
And, you know, I have a friend of mine who has a lawsuit against Microsoft right now because of GitHub Copilot, because he went in and he found his proprietary private repo algorithm in ChatGPT. And he was doing something very interesting and unique in the gaming industry. And I've seen his code, and there's no fucking way ChatGPT came up with it. Okay. I'm just sorry. It's just not happening. It's like ChatGPT suddenly inventing Van Gogh style.
No. ChatGPT is good for wireframes. It's not good for
totally
actual work.
Totally.
I have a question though, because I want to make sure we don't exceed our audience's knowledge. Explain I mean, I knew what you meant, but explain in your mind what Gutenberg moment is.
Well, Gutenberg, you know, invented the printing press.
Correct.
And with the printing press, it changed everything because now suddenly books could become accessible to a lot of people. Because previously, the way that all books were done is they were all hand transcribed, often by people in religion, going through and doing all of that, you know, because if you sit there and think about it, it's like kind of a weird skill to have. You've got to be like really smart and poor to do a lot of transcribing, right? So that's how that happened. But then with the Gutenberg, it suddenly became more and more open to people. And that's where you got, you know, an explosion of writing and an explosion of information and culture being able to be more and more available to people, because then you could print things like textbooks, and then you could print different things where you could teach more and more people how to read and write. Because, you know, before that, very few people actually did know how. I don't know what the percentages are, but I know that they were low.
Well, even the quality now is pretty low, right? I mean, the average, at least the average American can only read at like a fourth grade level or something like that, you know, and a lot of books are actually published at no more than an eighth grade level because our education system doesn't teach people how to think. So, okay. Next part of this is Fawcett. Let's discuss. Yes. Did I say that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's F-O-S-E-T. And it's Foundation for Open Source Ecosystem Technology. And for that, you know, the very first thing that we're doing is just open sourcing the platform that we've already created so that we can bring everybody in to start discussing it. Because, like, we've got several universities who want to run it for their open source program offices. We have several governments that are using it for their standardizations. Talking with some other nonprofits who care a lot about data privacy and data autonomy, and they want to use it. And so it's like, okay, let's all get together and do this, but do it in a way that we can all go after funding, because I'm using a bunch of other open source tools. I use Mattermost. I use GitLab. I use, you know, Big Blue Button. I use all these open source tools in regards to it. And I want to make sure that they stay and that they're, you know, doing well enough. So it's like, if we do different things, we can do the funding through the 501c3 and then distribute it to make sure that the open source projects get it the way that they need it. And I think that that's like the biggest problem that I see with the whole government procurement model is too often, you know, they just want to sign a check and have it be Accenture and have them go do this thing. And they don't, you know, they don't want to care. Right. While for us, it's like, well, there are ways that you should be doing this and there are ways that you should not be doing this. Right. You know, and so, and not to mention, I've way too often run into government offices where they're like, well, we don't want to be on Microsoft, but, you know, we don't want LibreOffice either. This is an old one. And they were like, well, and it was funny because government tried to give LibreOffice a bunch of money and LibreOffice said no, because they didn't have a way to handle it correctly among their developers, you know? And so I'm like, this could be an entity where we can do that. But we're also going to be doing our governance for it. Right. And so we're going to do governance where it's not just maintainer committer, you know, it's going to be a lot more than that, where we actually have, and we did some of this over at IEEE, where like the different user groups would get together and sit there and say, oh, I really need this tool, or oh, I really need this feature. And then they would go through an entire vetting process and then it would be added to the platform. You know, and so doing stuff like that, where, you know, the community comes together and say, oh yes, I really need this. Like the academic OSPOs go, hey, we need these things. Can you add them in? It's like, yes. Okay. Let's go add them in. Cause now we know that like this group of users want it, and then they do this whole feedback process where we work together on it. And that way we can get money and give it to the developers and give it to the other people who are, you know, spending time doing this work. And we don't, you know, exploit, you know, in the normal way that things get exploited.
How are you going to deal with the challenge? Now, Debian has tried this, you know, the official nonprofit for Debian is software in public interest. Right. And LibreOffice is also represented in the States by software in the public interest. They have their own in, I think it's France. But there's this ideology that permeates through open source that if you pay a developer, it is going to distract or discourage people to give for free. Now, in my mind, that is such a ridiculous argument because there's nothing free. My time is worth something. Now, you may not be giving me a dollar, but there's a value in my participation. And it's it's two-sided, right? I may find the value in affirmation of the work I'm doing or paying it forward, or it's I'm scratching an itch that I have. Right. That doesn't mean that there aren't parts of open source, which they're boring, idiosync, they're just ridiculous pieces that must be done. Documentation, I'm looking at you, because code is not documentation, period, the end. Mm-hmm. If you think it is, you're one of those people that's only good at one thing. You're not good at understanding the wider problem. Okay?
But documentation is a good example. Yeah.
And they went through this thing where they actually tried to raise some money to solve some problems with Debian. And a bunch of Debian is a largely, they've become a government amongst themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they are largely inefficient. That doesn't mean they're ineffective, but they are largely inefficient. And a lot of people came down and said, no, we can't pay for this. It's not right. It shouldn't be done. What is your plan for that problem? Because it permeates all of the old school open source people. It's only the new school open source people that understand that dollars mean something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm kind of not even going to address them, honestly.
Okay.
Because I think that, like you said, there are other different reasons people do that. And then they make a decision as to their participation, right? And so you can, I feel like as long as we're public about it, and so they're going, well, we have this much, we're doing this much, this is how we're deciding it, this is what we're doing. And the thing that I see that happens a lot, like at the Linux Foundation, for example, at Hyperledger, what was the most expensive budget item I had was security audits.
Oh, sure.
And the thing is we had a lot of corporate come in so that we could be a third party, you know, security audit and do all that kind of stuff correctly so that people would know, oh, it's gone through this pretty official process. And that's the main thing that I see as being a problem with open source is production readiness, is they don't take that in because that's the boring stuff that nobody wants to do for free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very rarely are there people who do production readiness to scratch an itch. It's just not that piece. And so it's like, that's the part that you need to pay for. And that was like the Red Hat model, right? As Red Hat had the open source, but then they were spending a lot of time and effort on production readiness,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that's what they did. And I'm going to sit here and, you know, they were successful at it. And then IBM took it. And then IBM, I still don't understand why IBM did what it did. Because it's like, oh, Red Hat was one of your main money makers. And now you went and stripped it down to where I don't know if it's going to continue to be, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years. Because of what you've done now. And so it's like, you know, so I look at a lot of that kind of stuff where I'm like, I think that there is something when you're selling to government, when you're doing all those different things where government did, you know, come over to the Red Hat side where they sat there and went, oh, yes, we now have someone to go shoot if something goes wrong, right? Which is what the government always wants. And now we can trust Red Hat enough so that we can go in there and do that. And that's how you got a lot of that conversion happening. And so I really would like to have a place where we can do a lot of that production readiness portion and deal with the stuff that's not fun. And, you know, you really do have to pay people for it.
You know, it's interesting that you would say that. I actually don't have a problem with what Red Hat did. I have a problem that they waited so long. Now don't get me wrong. I love my cake and eat it too perspective in terms of open source, but Red Hat hasn't done anything illegal. They're actually following pretty much the letter.
They didn't do anything illegal.
Yeah.
I just think it was dumb.
You know, from a goodwill perspective, sure. Mm-hmm. However, Red Hat's revenue model is IBM's revenue model, and that's government. It's Fortune mm-hmm. 500. They don't care about anything below that. All their money is right. derived from the industries that require some certification that IBM or Red Hat has. With that, I do understand why they did it. I gave up on Red Hat years ago. The 2.2 to 2.4 Linux kernel fiasco proved that Red Hat was not actually validating the code to a degree that could be considered mm-hmm. production ready. For those that don't know, Red Hat released a paid version of Linux that would just arbitrarily go to sleep. Because mm-hmm. of its virtual memory manager, it would just go to sleep. You wouldn't even know it was happening. All of a sudden you'd be working and the machine would just, well, in all intents and purposes, die. And it wasn't rare. It was across the board. It was to the point where Linus himself ripped it out and put in the old model from 2.2. And that's when I moved on to Ubuntu, and I haven't looked back. Now, that doesn't mean Ubuntu doesn't have its issues. It certainly does. But I'm not paying for those issues, so I accept the risk. Is there, as we're, you know, wrapping up here, is there anything that you would like to add, challenge, question, promote before we close out?
I don't know. I mean, we talked about the citability stuff. We talked about some of those other different pieces, and that was my main thing. I guess I know what I'll do. Any open source people out there, you need to get involved in standards. We're actually going to be launching in a short period of time a new standard at Eclipse Foundation on open source governance. So that we can talk about what those best practices are going to be, you know, focusing primarily on the shoulds, not the musts, but eventually, hopefully getting to the technical portions where we can talk more about the musts for different levels of projects and things of that nature. And one reason I say that we really do need this is because of, you know, government is getting involved. You know, there's the CRA stuff that's happening in the European Commission that's possibly going to be detrimental to open source because they don't fundamentally understand how it works. And so they're making some requirements. Honestly, it's all because of security. And I always see security as a result of not doing production readiness. If you were doing production readiness, you wouldn't be having these security flaws. but, you know, please consider getting involved in some of that. And so it's called OSGov.
I don't think it's our generation of open source developers that are going to buy into that. You need to be a particularly future forward thinking person. And it's hard for developers to do that. I mean, it's not that they don't exist, but they tend to get kind of head down. I think it's very good work. I think it's very important work. And I'm hoping that the newer generations of developers recognize that. Along with the idea of getting into standards, though, is that I ain't doing this for fucking free, right? So if you're gonna, if you want, and I'm not talking about me specifically, but the metaphorical me, if you want me to get involved in standards and all the bullshit that that entails, must versus should, that's a very IEEE thing. You better open your checkbook because my time is valuable and it is now short. I don't have extra 8 hours a day because I don't have to babysit my kid. Right. So I would encourage you along with that idea to make sure you can, if it's not you, that you're at least working toward entities that understand that this stuff doesn't happen for free. That's how you get the good work.
Right. Well, and that's why so many standards are corporately dominated, right? Is because they pay attorneys to go do it. And that's also why standards take so long and why so many of them are not very good. Is because of some of those aspects that come into play. That's actually another thing that I'm hoping we're going to get to do is help reboot standards. Because we've got all these amazing tools and all of these constructs. Like, so the CIA, I'll bring that book back. The CIA did this manual about how to sabotage a community in 1944. And I was joking that I was going to put a new cover on this and sit there and say, you know, standards manual. Because of all the different things that we do in standards that are all the different things that the CIA described as a way to like kill a community. Send it to committee, you know, reply all to everyone, bring the same argument up over and over again. And I feel like a lot of times in open source, we solve pieces of this, right?
Sure.
And so one of the things we're going to be experimentally doing over at Eclipse is we're going to be using GitLab. So that you can actually see the versioning and see the comments. And that way you can, because, you know, there's always that dude, right, who brings up, you know, spaces versus tabs, right? And he does it once a year. We all know this guy, right? We do. We all know this guy. And they have the same thing in standards, too. It's like, oh, guess what? That dude works for Apple. Guess what he's going to bring up again? Right? Do you know what I mean? And it's like, and we just automatically go past it in open source because it's like, it's, you know, this issue is this issue. There's just, you know, we can sit there and we can document it. We can sit there and go, here he is again, da da da, because we've got it all written out. And I feel like there's more stuff like that that we can do to like fix and accelerate standards, because if we don't accelerate standards, we're in serious trouble.
Oh, no question.
You know, the way that technology is going now, it's like, oh my God, like how much faster I am on so many different things is kind of scary. And if we don't get faster at these things, we're going to be in serious trouble.
All right. Well, I'm going to close this out with a story about spaces versus tabs real quick. All right. So for those that don't know, first off, the answer is spaces. But the issue here is that for a long time, so text editors interpret your characters by a special character that you're not seeing. It's a meta character of some sort. And for a long time, people use tab when they're coding for proper indentation, or spaces, a number of spaces. Over time, it kind of self-standardized into a tab was either the equivalent of, underneath it wasn't this, but it was the equivalent distance of either 4 spaces or 8 spaces. So what would happen is, depending on the editor that you had, you would open up and it would detect a tab. And depending on the setting of the editor, all your stuff would move either 4, the equivalent distance of 4 spaces or 8 spaces, which is why a lot of editors have the ability to say interpret tab as tab or interpret tab as spaces. And if it's a tab, how long of a tab, 4 spaces or 8 spaces. Now, here's where it gets interesting. This is a particular problem with a very popular programming language called Python, which is interpreted by white space. Back in my coding days, I had a particular love affair with Python because it made me look better than I actually am at programming. Okay? This is what I did. Instead of 4 or 8, I used 3 spaces, which made all of my code unique regardless of tabs or spaces, and I never had an editor that would just rewrite the formatting of my code. And it was really funny because I had, this is when I was directly engineering with engineers who were quite much better than I was. And I had a particularly talented and brilliant engineer come to me and go, "What in the hell are you doing?" Because I was using 3 spaces. And I explained exactly why I used 3 spaces. And he sat back and blinked and said, "That is the most logical thing I have ever heard for a reason of people breaking a standard. I'm still not going to do it." Right? And with this, folks, this has been More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it, or interviews with the most interesting people you've never heard of. And our guest today was Salona Bonewald, an amazing lady who I think might have a little bit too much time on her hands.